On va commencer. La question de l'individu, elle se pose bien sûr pour les humains vivants, on l'a dit aussi pour les non-humains, mais pour les humains morts de façon toute particulière, parce qu'il n'est pas toujours facile de faire des enquêtes pour savoir quel type d'individu ils sont, où ils ont été. Et pour parler de l'individuation, de l'individualité chez les humains morts, j'ai demandé à Eonik Kwon de venir nous parler de son travail, du travail qu'il mène depuis plusieurs années sur, au fond, la mémoire des morts de la guerre du Vietnam, à la fois les morts vietnamiens et les morts non vietnamiens, c'est-à-dire les morts américains et les morts coréens. Eonik Kwon est d'origine coréenne, il enseigne à l'université de Cambridge, et il a mené depuis des années un travail, une enquête ethnographique sur cette question de la mémoire des morts au Vietnam. Il a publié plusieurs livres sur ce thème. Le premier livre s'appelle Memory of a Massacre, non ?
After the Massacre.
After the Massacre, oui, après le massacre. Et c'est un livre qui est consacré à la mémoire de deux massacres, dont l'un est très connu en France, c'est celui de Mylai, on dit Mylai, qui a eu beaucoup d'écho en Europe, qui était le massacre d'un village par l'armée sud-vietnamienne et l'armée américaine. Et un deuxième livre qui s'appelle « Ghosts of War in Vietnam », sur la façon dont les fantômes sont traités au Vietnam. Alors, effectivement, il y a plusieurs possibilités pour un humain, après la mort, notamment au Vietnam, mais pas simplement. On peut devenir un ancêtre, donc c'est un individu d'une certaine sorte, ça c'est ce qui, quand les choses se passent bien. Et puis on peut devenir un fantôme, quand les choses se passent mal, c'est-à-dire en cas de mauvaise mort, c'est-à-dire quand on ne meurt pas entouré de sa famille, au village, dans les conditions normales, et que l'on est condamné, au fond, à une vie d'errance, qui est le cas un peu partout des fantômes, et tant que, au fond, les conditions rituelles et sociales n'ont pas été remplies pour que l'on puisse réintégrer, c'est tout particulièrement le cas au Vietnam, réintégrer l'univers social, familial, villageois. Et donc, je suis très heureux que Eonik Kwon ait réussi à passer la frontière entre le Royaume-Uni et la France pour venir ici, puisqu'elle est encore passable, pour venir nous parler de ses enquêtes et de ses travaux sur les fantômes au Vietnam et d'une manière générale, comment l'individualité se constitue et se poursuit au-delà de la mort. Eonik Kwon va parler en anglais, il comprend bien le français, il le parle même un peu, mais effectivement, sur des sujets comme celui-là, il a préféré parler anglais. Cela dit, les questions que vous pourrez lui poser après l'exposé, vous pourrez les poser en français. Il répondra en anglais. Merci.
Merci Philippe. Bonjour à tous. Et comme Philippe a dit que je vais présenter mes discours en français, non, en anglais, mais vous pouvez poser toutes vos questions en français si vous voulez. It's good to go back to what I'm going to talk about. I'll speak rather slowly today, and it's good to go back to my earlier work in Vietnam through these opportunities. And there's Gregory de Laplace, and I gave a similar talk in Musée Cap Rang Ly some time ago, and and I do other things these days, but related subject. But today, thanks to Philip, I'm going to look into the condition of war commemoration in contemporary Vietnam through the lenses of individuality. And I found it really stimulating to think about it in such a way. But before getting into some details, such as I have a paragraph here on, actually, because of all these troubles of Brexit and all the Eurostars are cancelled this afternoon, so I'm happily stuck in Paris. I can't go back, so I cancelled the meeting tomorrow in London. So I'm flying to Marrakesh this afternoon. And there is an interesting meeting among some African historians of North Africa and French historians on the First Indochina War. That was France versus Vietnam, you know. And then the Vietnam War, Philippe was talking about, mentioning, is about Vietnam versus United States, which is in part continuation of earlier First Indochina War, but which was different war. But so the lives of ghosts to be introduced briefly today from both wars, you know, because there were people who were killed during the First Indochina War, what the Vietnamese call the French War, and the Second Indochina War is American one, Zhong Mi Zhong Fa. And so I can't distinguish between, you know, those who stayed on as a ghost from, you know, pre 1954 era versus those from post 1960 era. It's all mixed up. But nevertheless, the subject of First Indochina War is really becoming a hot topic, and particularly by historians and scholars on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean today, because the question of why United States joined the Vietnam War that was started a long time ago by other actors. And so, and also, there are a couple of ghosts today, I hope, whose stories, I hope to introduce some stories about the North African ghosts, because during the First Indochina War, quite many Moroccans and Algerians joined the war in Vietnam. In France, the Algerian war is a big thing. It still is, holds on a huge, large place in this country's collective memory. It's still unsolved in many ways. But the Vietnam War in this country, we don't talk about Vietnam War that much. But in the United States, there are more scholars who are working on, you know, early Vietnam War, in First Indochina War. There are many reasons for that. It's really interesting. We're going to talk about the Africa and Asia tomorrow in Marrakesh, and how the empire mobilizes human and material resources from different continents, but at the same time, by doing so, against its intention, ends up connecting these two continents in some ways. So the Vietnamese, people in central Vietnam remember vividly the presence of Algerian soldiers and Moroccans. They have difficulty in separating who are Algerians and Moroccans, but North African soldiers, and their traces remain there still today. So tomorrow is about that, if you like, Afro-Asian connections and through France. Yeah, it should be interesting. But before getting into some details about why in Vietnam the memories of war are kept in many forms by the state, by the society, by the community, but in very loose phenomenon called the life of ghosts. But before getting into that, because it's the Collège de France, and Philippe is there, and Philippe has written this fantastic, a work on the relationship between totemism and animism. It's a part of anthropology of nature. It's totemism and animism are big things in the history of the discipline I belong to, anthropology, particularly in France. And totemism is basically, we need a symbol like a panthéon to feel that we are together. Otherwise, we are not together. We need symbols, the why we are together, right? And on the other hand, there are things that cannot be captivated by this, the symbolism of totem. Kind of, if you like, loose animi. So there are names, if you like, there are names that are not introduced to Panthéon, but who in certain circles people believe truly merit a place in Panthéon, right? So those who are excluded from totemic circles and those who are introduced to this authoritative, powerful totemic circles and things like that. So in that way, I'm translating, bringing Philip's, much bigger and much more profound work on the relationship between totemism and animism into, I'm kind of banalizing it, but that is very much part of today's paper. And before, so I'm going to slowly get into that, and several names, three French names and two German names will be introduced very briefly, and it's a great founding ancestors of French sociological school, Durkheim, Marcel Mauss, and Robert Hertz, very briefly, who were working around here once a century ago, during a really critical time of European democracy. And then there were two German names. One is Philippe's works mentions this, and Ferdinand Tönnies, and it's a vital constitutive scholar in the idea of individuality and communities, and George Zimmel, very briefly. Okay, but the tone of my discourse today turns to Marcel Mauss specifically. Marcel Mauss, in 1905, it's a relatively less known work. His work, Essai sur le Don, is world famous. You should be proud that everybody is reading Marcel Mauss. Asia, and I know in South Africa they are reading. So a relatively smaller work by Marcel Mauss, published originally in L'Année Sociologique, the flagship journal of French sociological school, which is called L'Année Sociologique, actually. He published, and then later translated in English. I think it was, English version was 1955. And so, Seasonal Variations of Eskimo. Marcel Mauss here talks about the ecology, social ecology of Inuit people, and he contrasts the way people in the Arctic region conduct their lives in the summer time versus the way they live in the winter time. So in the winter time, it's cold. It's really cold, like today, and very windy. And so people are ensconced in their well-sheltered house, in the collective house called Kasim. And then they do all sorts of interesting things. They share many things and do collective rituals. So Mauss calls this, emblematic example of a communal life. Or he even calls it as a communism, not communism in the sense of Soviet communism, but fundamental human communal life. These communism in the sense something that is embedded in human life as such, not in the sense of 20th century ideological divide. We can't live without communism. Communism is essential to being a human. But so they get together and they so the private property completely mostly disappears, and people share many things, and they do incredibly interesting rituals throughout the winter, right, to keep it going. Whereas in the summer, because people have to subsist, and their subsistence relies on hunting, so individual families are dispersed in large terrain, so they don't meet each other. So it's all segregated, distributed. People live apart from each other. And he calls a time of individuality, or even individualism. So people live as individuals in particular season, and people live as, if you like, communists. As I said, not in the sense of communism in today's vocabulary, but in kind of almost authentic sense. You know, we are all communists. We are born into a community, like family or neighborhood. That is communism. And so people do live as individuals in one season and as communists in another season. There is a catch in it. In French sociological school, in the heritage of French sociological school, and more globally, Marcel Mauss is known to be the genius theorist of exchange, theory of exchange. And a key term for that describes his work as such, particularly in relation to his work on gift, is reciprocity. So I give a part of myself to you in the form of a gift. You know, alliance, for instance. When I declare that I belong to you, just as you belong to me, I give, through this act of giving you this ring, I give not this ring as a thing, but I give my part of myself. I give a pledge, but part of you, myself. So we are not separable, or something like that. So this reciprocity is a key term, but his work on gift was published in 1925, and 2 decades before, he coined this term reciprocity in this work. So what happens is, what is remarkable about the way these humble people in the Arctic Circle conduct their lives is not necessarily the way they live in the winter, nor the way they live in the summer. That is, the way they act as an individuals. He exaggerates a little bit, right? But nevertheless, the way they live as communal beings, or almost like a communist in the winter, what is most remarkable is how they relate these two forms of life. So he calls this as art of reciprocal effects. So when you live in the summer, although you're busy with hunting, and I sometimes enjoy my private life, if you like, you know, living together with others and doing rituals can be, you know, laborious thing to do. There are people we do particularly like, and there are people I don't particularly fancy being with, but you are obliged to live together in this communal house in the winter. But in the summer, I don't have to go through that. Yes, but I conduct my life as individual in the summer with a memory of life in the winter, the winter before, and in anticipation for being together in following winter. So this is reciprocal effect. So although the seasons are divided, and forms of life, he classified these forms of life, seasonal variations, into two parts. What he is most focused is the way these two forms of life are meeting together and conversing together and interacting together in daily life, both in the summer and in the winter. So this is recipe. So in extension, if you allow me to just go on just one more minute, that we can interpret his work on the gift is not about giving things to you and expecting to receiving some things back from you. It is more than giving a part of myself to you and expecting that you do the same. It is about how to construct a modern world away from the great divide between, if you like, empire of liberty and empire of equality, or the kind of political society that is singularly focused on the question of individualism, the kind of political society that rejects this and focuses instead on absence of private property and communal life. Already, that has started in the beginning of 20th century, before it materialized in post-war era. I'm talking about post-World War II era, the Cold War, right? And so so Moss has this, when he writes about the art of reciprocity between two forms of life of the Inuits, he's focused on the ethnography and every detail of it, but he has something else in his mind. How modern science, modern social science, especially anthropology, can contribute to combating this bifurcating forces of modern politics, you know, what we can do. And that is first thing. So he has, if you go back and the Dreyfus affairs and French society was a very polarized society at the time, left and right, and then immediately before, shortly before the destruction of 1418 and also Russian Revolution. So it's run up to this critical moment. That he already felt that we have to do something. So ethnographers, anthropologists, do write about other forms of life, but at the same time, they do so in view of the general human condition, including the West, including Europe and everything. So in that way, he was, I think, this Seasonal Variations of Eskimo Life is one very damn important work in the progression of the theory of modern individual. So which I'll briefly go back through Ferdinand Tönnies. So I want you to imagine summertime and wintertime in the very north. But at the same time, it's cold and less cold, but it's morphology. Moss talks about morphology of time. Morphology of time in a sense, very separated lives and communal life. But instead of focusing one form of life as against the other, and then combating one form of life in view of other form of life that I align myself with, we focus on how to generate the art of reciprocity between the two. And he, at the end of the work, he believes this is what human condition is. We all live as individuals, as well as we all, and communal beings. Let's call it communists and individuals, a la most. We are all individualists, but at the same time, we are all communists. These two are not contradictory to each other. These two elements constitute the fundamental basis of human life everywhere, both modern Europe and in tribal northern region. But modern ideology, as was advancing in the 19th century, in the beginning of 20th century, separates these two necessary and vital aspects of being a human into two mutually negating, mutually combating, mutually arguably incompatible ideological forms, and he wanted to combat that. So that's a political side to this whole work on individuality and communality in the history of modern anthropology. And Philippe Descola knows that better than most other people. But there's another element to it, which is which was very strong in German philosophical and sociological school of the time. I mean, it affected French philosophical and sociological school as well, but it was stronger in Germany. And that was, you know, I'll go very briefly on that. It's about, you may have heard Gemeinschaft and Gesellschaft. So it is basically about, imagine you are someone, I can't think of an example in France, but some, you know, in Germany, it's like if you imagine you are someone born and bred in Bavaria, for instance, and for some reasons you leave home, you end up in this dazzling modernity of Berlin in the beginning of 20th century. I'm alone. It's fantastic. You know, Berlin at the time was transforming into a replica of Paris, right? People have never seen that. It's French modernity is both old and new, and, you know, old classicism versus, you know, fantastic modernity. And you end up there, and you've never seen anything like that. It's dazzling. And on the one hand, you feel so free from Bavarian kind of everyday ritual, having to eat sausages in the morning for breakfast, and, you know, like having to sing together, and, you know, it's patriotic songs and patriarchal, whatever, you know, still a bit like the Bavaria. No offense to Bavarians, if there is one. I love Bavaria. But in Berlin, it's, people are so, you know, cool, and Max Weber is around, and George Gimbel is around, and, you know, so many literary figures, and French beer salons are rising everywhere, and intellectuals come together, huddle together, talk about politics and aesthetics and art, and what kind of life is it? This is proper life, but at the same time, I know no one. There is a hierarchy. It's not a hierarchy you are born into, but which school you went to and what kind of houses you live in, if, you know, whether you live Rive Gauche, Rive Droite, or Banlieue. And so these are there, and since I know no one, I'm, you know, almost like Albert Camus, étranger. But the thing is, so the German scholars who of the time tried to theorize this experience of moving from Bavaria to Berlin, so displacement from what they call community, you know, like where you are born into, village community or small town community, where everybody knows everyone. Everybody pretends to be nice to each other, but everybody is horrible to each other, or something like that. And so it's a small town experience, but in Berlin, you feel so free, and it still goes on to current days. You're so free, but here, apart from a few old bourgeoisie, everybody is a stranger to one another. So it's an aggregate of strangers. And how to build some sort of like solidarity among these unrelated individuals who don't regard each other as a co-inhabitant of the same place was the question. So these Ferdinand Tennis and George Gimmels and many brilliant German sociologists squarely focus on two forms of human solidarity. One form you're born into, or you believe you're born into. The other form you choose, and you have to construct together. So this is modern society. It's a society of contracts, and so it's a, you know, We are familiar with that. We live in that. But we have this other thing going on as well in pockets of France today, even in Paris. And then if we look, if we search our everyday life more closely, we carry on as communals in many aspects of our life. But in thinking, we believe that we have to be equal to each other. We are strangers to each other. Strangers to each other means that it comes with many other things. So we may need law, civil law, kind of rules that deal with how to conduct proper business as strangers to each other, further on, how to construct a meaningful political society out of these strangers. So these two things going on, and so at that time I see there was a certain divergence between French sociological school and German sociological circles. That German sociological circles, the theory of community and individuality was more like a one-way street, what Walter Benjamin said, one-way street. So from community to individuality. So you move from Bavaria to Berlin. Whereas in France, it was affected by this one-way street philosophy of social change. But at the same time, knowing that this one-way street philosophy of social evolution or social transformation doesn't say everything about human condition. There is something else going on. And then, someone like Marcel Mauss especially was very much concerned about how this one-way street philosophy is creating the illusion that once you are in the society of strangers, as Tennis was describing, you forget that you actually carry on the memories of your life in the summer or winter into the life of summer. So what he was arguing is that how people who live in the summer camp, they believe they are individuals. But whereas their belief is viable to the extent that they forget their life in the wintertime, in Inuit sense. So they forget their life in the Inuit sense of wintertime. So that's why they think it's the logic of the ideology of individual society, modern society, is viable. It's about forgetting. And later on, another eminent scholar of French sociological school, Maurice Albach, took on this aspect, and he wrote a very important book on collective memory about forgetting and remembering. Anyway, so what I'm basically saying at the outset is that both when anthropologists write about the ecological patterns of life in Inuit, we try to relate what we do to the imminent and vexing conditions of the contemporary time. And I think that's what Marcel Mauss tried to do, and that heritage I think is very important to keep and empower. So and in my very small way, in my very, very, very small way, I try to bring this idea of reciprocity between two forms of life, two forms of being, or two forms of solidarity into what ordinary people do in Vietnam today, in relation to their experience of the destruction of war. Right. So the introduction for my paper is much longer than what I just said, but I'm mindful of the fact that perhaps the factuality or the ethnography itself is more entertaining than, you know, the history of the controversy or the history of ideas in relation to the concept of the individual. Yes. So if I have a bit of time to the end, or during the question time, I'll come back to these ideas. And I skip through George Zimmel, and I'll try to find a time to relate some other heritages of German sociological school into our conversation about individuality. Right. So, the Vietnam. Vietnam, if you like, I at the outset I briefly mentioned the First Indochina War and Second Indochina War, and the aspect of continuity and possible aspect of discontinuity between these two wars. And I'll focus on discontinuity for the sake of today's talk. Discontinuity is that during the First Indochina War, when when the Vietnamese fought against the French, the society was heavily affected, you know, in material terms, and many human lives were lost, but nevertheless, it was not civil war. There was a general sense that there are many Vietnamese in southern and central Vietnam who fought with the French, but in a way the families may have been divided between brothers who went to Viet Minh revolutionary forces or nationalist forces at the time, and those who worked or who had to accommodate French economy and politics to a certain extent, right? But the division within the community was, relatively speaking, far less critical than what would unfold in the following war, in the Vietnam War. So Vietnam War Vietnamese official rhetoric is Vietnam's kind of solid and united kind of struggle against U.S. forces. But it's far from the case in southern Vietnam. And it was a civil war. People were brought into Saigon governments, and people volunteered to join to fight against revolutionary forces, and as well as many youth and took to join the revolutionary role. So it's a typical story: is villages divided between those who joined American war on the American side and the revolutionary side, and within the family it's divided, and it goes on. And if we push that divisiveness to a bit further on, even if I work for the Saigon government, my brothers and sisters who are on the revolutionary side, so I'm divided. So it appears that the brothers and sisters are divided. But what goes on is there is kind of undercurrent communication between the two. Yeah, it's sad that we are divided, but this is the way we sustain the family, right? So there are so many cases that, you know, even if I work for the Saigon government and then I help out the sustenance of the family, and whereas so that my brothers and sisters can work more freely on the revolutionary you know, activism and things like that. And although there are troubles, I think there was a still sense and at familial and communal level that this divisiveness shouldn't consume our communal identities. I'm really overgeneralizing. There are so many cases that counter my very characteristic rendering of the human experience of Vietnam War. But I think I'm right to say that the Second Indochina War, in Chinese War, was far more painful in the sense that its effects continue to be felt in everyday social life up to the present time. Yeah. And it was a civil war, and it was a very modern, mechanized war, and it, based on mobilization of human forces, there was large scale of displacement. So young people joined the revolutionary forces, go away from home, and young people, or even not that young people, joined the Saigon government. They travel around to fight the partisans. So there's large scale of displacement, and the whole agricultural basin in the Mekong Delta was in turmoil, so people had to be uprooted from their home. So one interesting aspect of the Second Indochina War was the Saigon soldiers, mostly from Mekong Delta, 15, 16 years old, 17 years old, and they originally were displaced from home into mobile forces, but their families had to join them because the life became intolerable back home. So there were, there's a displacement was not only it was not necessarily restricted to a certain sector of population, but it was general experience. On the top of it, the Vietnamese culture of commemoration emphasizes what they call good death. Good death is, not necessarily entirely happy life, but you die in the place you call your home, in longevity, and not experiencing violence. So it's a humane death, surrounded by your loved ones. That's good death. And bad death is away from home. Death in displacement is absolutely horrendous. Bad death. Why? Because there are nobody around to take care of your soul and body through this very important ritual of interment and commemoration. So you're absolutely solitary. So you become in a very ontological sense, a stranger to yourself and to the world, and you become an individual, but really in a sorry state. So you're all alone. So there is nobody else. So that creates the condition of grievous spirits who can't find a place in the other world, so who are obliged to roam around in the world of the living, wanting to enter the other world, but not knowing how to do, because it is a lost. It becomes a lost soul. So, because we are talking about traditional culture of commemoration, traditional culture of the concept of death, what constitutes proper death, and what not, but. The trouble is the experience of the Vietnam War from 1960 to 75 magnified the number and intensity of bad death all over. So, soldiers whose bodies became traceless because it was a very mechanized war. And then people who were hastily buried in the distant parts of Indochina broadly, like in Laotian border. and then alone. But the comrades put a shallow grave, but all these comrades disappeared shortly afterwards, so the information was not relegated to the family. So the family is waiting, not ideally the return of this their relatives, but at least some news about when and how they died, so that you can at least in haphazard way to do certain commemorative ritual at home, but not knowing what time and what date and in which circumstances they died, it's impossible to do proper ritual. So the civil war conditions of 1960 to 1975 once again magnified the economy of bad death in Vietnam. And so this is since 1990s. And then we may add another aspect of displacement. So there is a physical displacement away from home that creates crisis in culture of commemoration. But after the war was over in 1975 and the country was unified, like all revolutionary states of modern times, the Vietnamese state tried to bring people, take people away from what they defined as backward and feudal customs of, you know, giving food and incense nonstop, you know, on a daily basis to their ancestors. So in many ways, it's a typical of the politics of modern state, particularly revolutionary state, that actually the state considered itself in stark competition with authority at home, which is ancestral spirits, right? Unless you break this authority of ancestral spirits, these households and community cannot be entirely or meaningfully integrated into new society you are building, the political society. This political society is not a society of individuals, but it had to, this society had to be built in order to do so. We had to break this authority of existing communal authority, namely the ancestors. So there are many cases in, ancestral commemoration and rituals for ancestral death were very much discouraged. And then for many years from 1975 till 90s, the Vietnamese popular religion had kind of underworld, you know, upper world people do venerate Ho Chi Minh and everything, the revolutionary relics, but underneath people did all sorts of things, including their ancestors. And so the situation, but the situation was such that as I spoke briefly, the consequences of bad death, right? The consequences of bad death turn into spectral existences, and you know the number has magnified, and people are aware of it because everybody has some of their close relations missing from the war. Everybody knows that. But the revolutionary politics resulted in the displacement of ancestors as well. You know, the consequences of good death, old ancestors who enjoyed longevities and whose memories, families regularly ran ritual commemoration for at home. So ancestor was a displaced from home in less radical way, because as I said, there were two-tier economy because people were doing black economy of ancestor worship for many years. But nevertheless, both ancestors and non-ancestral spirits, the intensity of displacement among the ancestral spirits was also remarkable phenomenon in post-war situation 1975 and up until recent time. So the starting from mid-1990s, when the Vietnam joined the world economy, and now it is thriving in absolutely fantastic way, despite many problems. But it's wonderful, transforming society at the moment. Things are changing every day. The first thing most people wanted to do in southern parts of Vietnam, you know, Annam, it used to be called, was to all these displaced spirits back home. That was the first thing to do. So it's quite amazing, you know. When things get better, and then when we have extra small amount of cash, I sell coconuts and things like that. I get a small cash, and I'll open a small street corner shop or street side shop, and then I'm able to renovate my house. You know, state wants me to renovate things, so I renovate my house. It's remarkable in many cases, not in all cases. The first thing that people did in the renovation of their place, from thatched roof to a solid brick houses, or if you like, was to build a serious ancestral altar. So renovation goes to ancestors first before it is materialized among the living. I mean, counter examples exist, but in my observations, so in a way, you renovate, you try to better the condition of life of the dead first before you do the equivalent for the living. For many reasons, you know, the reasons behind it can be very complex. But that was what people were doing. But at the same time, especially in the central region, as soon as you renovate or in parallel with the renovation of ancestral home at the center of your living space, you build something, a modest shelter, in the outside. Every home has this. Every home has this. In the beginning, the local Communist Party resisted it, and we ran educational course and enlightenment courses once again. But the popular zeal was just unstoppable. People were building, and the builders were doing lobbying, you know, it's good for business, you know. And then, so in the end, everybody was building this second house, if you like. It's called, in Central Vietnamese language, it's called hom. It's it doesn't mean nothing. It's tang tơ. It's a modest place outside your living house. It's a shelter, or it can be a temporary residence for the consequences of bad death. So at home, so if you imagine the situation. So I have worked really hard from 1979, and then especially from 1988, and then I did some commerce, and I have $500 in possessions. So I invest $400 for renovating my ancestral shrine. It's initiating or kind of turning the black economy shrine into fabulous open economy shrine, you know, is with many dazzling objects and a proper sort of proper shelves and many instruments, many goods to go with ancestral commemoration. But at the same time, I keep $100 to build this external home for shelter for unknown strangers. So this was the general phenomenon, and people when I met people for morning coffees, a very strong coffee, good coffee, as good as French espresso coffee, yeah, but very sugary, yeah, very sugary. It wakes you up, but it makes you hungry. You have to go straight to have a pho. You know? So coffee first and have pho is the opposite, yeah. And And so people, what people are talking about is where to go to get a better deal for to build a home, to build a shelter for wandering ghosts. And then, you know, what style they do. And in some communities, people disapprove of the fact that they build more enticing, you know, shrine for ghosts in comparison to the altar inside for ancestors. The ghost shrines became more magnificent than the shrine for ancestors. Well, so people were debating, is it because they have many souls lost from the war, or is it because ancestors are lazy? You know, they are home and they are well and well-fed, but the ghosts have to really work hard to have entitlement to have to a small shelter, so they work really hard, which means in this context they will be very devoted to finding elements of luck for this family. They travel around too, right? Unlike ancestors who are sitting home all the time, you know, imaginatively. They're sitting home. How do they get any information in open economy about how other communities, about the condition of the world? The ghosts travel around. So they are very streetwise and agile. So you have to really, you know, make serious relationship with these beings. And then they are also much more committed to doing good to the hosting family, because it's so generous of the family to build a shelter for humble beings like myself, you know, wandering soul. So they are very grateful. They will do extra nice to you. So in some communities, they were, I know cases, they built these ghost shrines first before they proceeded to ancestral altar. And then many people just very disapprove of this utilitarian thinking. You know, it's kind of utilitarian thinking in the sense that thinking that is not grounded in moral integrity. And even though ancestors can be less effective than these stranger spirits outside, you can't do that. You have to do good things for your inside before you proceed to the outside. And the typical mode of every day, so you wake up in the morning and you, so imagine you wake up in the morning before boiling the kettle, you bring a fresh water to the ancestral altar, and your six-year-old child, is as soon as she wakes up, she goes out to the field and bring two or three fresh flowers, wild flowers, to offer to the ancestors. It's very modest. Yeah. But that's the first thing you do in many homes. And then immediately afterwards, and then you cook a meal, and then part of the meal goes to the ancestors, and then modest amount to the external shrine. That's what people do, and it is repeated in the evening. And on the 15th lunar day, which is known to be the day that is for some really old kind of oriental religious reasons, that 15th of lunar month is the day that the spirits, wandering spirits especially, are very active. They travel around a lot. So the people do especially nice food offerings in the evening, and sometimes the woman of the house come out in the thick of night and burning, kowtowing to this external shrine. What goes on in her mind when she does is beyond our imagination. I mean, there are multiple other things going on. For instance, my daughter is working in a factory near Saigon, near Ho Chi Minh City, and she overworked, and then she's a bit frail, and she got sick. So you pray for her well-being, But at the same time, we can easily imagine for an elderly lady who is a matron of this house, but she has authority, but not, you know, her authority is challenged by her son, who has a decent position in local Communist Party. And so, because the Communist Party has changed the position of in relation to popular religion by then, so he tolerates his aging mother to do gong, do ancestral worship at home. And it has taken more time for him to accept the fact that she can build this external home for ghosts. Okay, that's the traditional culture, that's fine. It's Vietnam's traditional culture, it's okay. Okay, but he still hasn't made peace with the fact that his younger brother fought together with the Saigon army, and then his body was lost, and his elder brother was a Kakbang, a revolutionary partisan fighter. So we do ancestral worship for this man at home, but we don't do that for the other one, the youngest brother. He doesn't do that. His wife doesn't do that. But his mother wants to do it. So she can't do it at home because it is because if she does, it creates problem between her and her son, and therefore her daughter-in-law. So she does silently in the external home, external shelter for her lost son. So this situation, it sounds a bit complex, but because of the experience of generalized displacement of life during the war, and the distinction between who are ancestors and who are not, and what do you care for in internal shrine and external shrine, much less clear than in traditional times. I don't know when this traditional times was, pre-French War or many old days, but if ever existed this French, traditional time, the what people do now in between this inside and outside, if you like a concentric circle inside and outside, is much less clear than before. And the distinction, hierarchy between the internal ancestral altar versus external shrine is much less clear than before. And in this context, in this situation, what most people do on a daily basis is, as I said, you know, offer fresh water and flowers and sometimes rice gruel. Nowadays it's some sweets, packaged sweets from supermarket to the ancestors. And then you buy cheaper bonbon and cheaper ones, and you know, usually have to be cheaper. And then you offer to the external shrine. So you kowtow to ancestral altar, turn your body, come out, and then perform the equivalent in face of the external shrine. So the book Philippe kindly mentioned deals with this this human body. It focuses on the human body that that turns between the internal and external shrines. So here is a catch on individuality. So ancestral shrines, I did mention briefly, very briefly, Ferdinand Tennis. It's almost like it's a bit like a Bavaria, you know, if you like Bavarian. So the ancestral worship is a Bavaria. It's we believe we are related, and that's the end of it. And then we are solidary with each other. And this why we are related, why we are solidary with each other, doesn't need explanation, right? It has to be done. So ancestral worship is unquestioned even among serious members of Communist Party. You know, even before 1990s, and many eminent members of local Communist Party tolerated there is a gender division. They don't offer food to their ancestors, and they don't even have a you know, shelter for ancestors, but they tolerate their children and their wives do that in modest way in the kitchen and everything. So this has been going on. But when they come out outside, the ghosts, of course, they are not individual in the classical sense of the term, you know, in tennis sense of the term, from Bavaria to Berlin. And then you encounter not your related beings, you know, your like beings, as in Bavaria. Everybody knows each other, and I know everybody else. But in Berlin, you know no one, and it's society of strangers. So it's society of strangers is how to bring the society of strangers to society of individuals. So the transition in Tennis's work, in German sociological thought, in how to transform the condition of being stranger to each other to the society of individuals is a political question. Is you need a law, you need a certain, you know, all the things that modern society and politics requires for this bunch of unrelated individuals to live harmonious together, you know, reasonably harmonious together, without violating each other's rights, human rights, civil law, and everything, and the power of the state, especially. The power of the state that can enforce on these unrelated people certain sense of being together in many ways. And then and to punish those who violate the civil conduct. And so the ghosts are not, the Vietnamese ghosts are not individuals in classical sense, but it, in comparison to the status of ancestors, they have elements of modern individuals. See, there are several things. First, in relation to the host society, for the family, they are unknown. They are imagined to be unknown. They are strangers to the family. So, but they exist. And among themselves, unlike ancestors who are together and who don't question why we have to be together, the ghosts do not relate to each other as in the form of some sort of togetherness. They carry on their unique autonomous life. This is difficult to convey, and it will take a lot of deliverance of facts and you know, to convey how the even in this condition of afterlife after the war, the contrast between ancestors and ghosts have elements akin to the contrast between community and modern society and etc. But I will limit my introduction only to two things. For instance, the moment of death is quite important. For instance, in one village, there are two, what people believe, two American GI ghosts, right? And then they make a strange noise, sort of like in spoons in empty can. Each time they move, they travel around, they make strange noise. And they relate to each other. They are quite close to, they always move along, but they don't relate to no one else. Not the villagers or, so they are solitary beings, but they are together. And then the people understand their distinctive character in terms of being lost during the combat situation, and they are very hungry, because it is, if you hear this clinking noise, which means the can is empty. And there is another, in the nearby village, there is Algerian. It's not very clear, but I studied the local historical map, and then there were 2,000 Algerian soldiers in the heat of French War, 1950 and 51, and in the barracks, and the people do see and prolifically talk about this particular Algerian ghost, who has a particular you know, kind of liking to astonishing people, especially on the young ladies coming back from the marketplace or something or other. So people do attach distinctive characters of distinctive individual characters, if you like, to each being. And but of course these beings are speechless, you know, because they in apparition people see apparitions, people hear strange noises and they characterize. But occasionally these beings have this kind of find this opening to reveal themselves to the community more in solid ways. For instance, and these incidents are typically of some unknown spirit in the process of turning into local genie, locally important spiritual entity. I mean, there are many occasions such as this. For instance, 12-year-old girl from Hue, and the place I worked is mostly in Greater Da Nang region in central Vietnam, and Hue is further north. So during the chaos, she was immediately, you know, 1967, in the winter of 1967, she got lost and she got drowned, and her body took to the river, and her body was lodged in much further down south. And many years later, so due to many sort of contingent reasons, and then her spirit came to assert herself to the local community. And then when she became a reasonably powerful goddess, and she, in very poetic forms, reveals her biographical story about herself. You know, I was there, and then I grew up, and then I was all alone, and then but I knew that you were coming, you're passing by, going to the paddy fields, and then I lost my younger brother as well, and so she talks about her biography, and she elicits her historical subjectivity to the locals. And later on, the local people accepted her as a sort of like minor goddess, and then built a small shrine on her behalf. And what the locals believe is that she is particularly effective in finding lost children's souls from the war time. So the local woman who does often speak to this particular ghost come goddess entity in the form of spirit possession. You know, spirit takes over the body of a particular local woman, and through her she speaks about stories. And then, this has been going on in the community for some years, and this local woman, as well as her neighbors, through their long experience with particular goddess spirit, came to believe that she's not like any other spirits. For instance, you know, she's not like any other spirit. She has a particular passion. She has a You know, her fate in the previous life, being lost. I mean, there is other story. Her father was you know, really into drinking, and so abandoned the family. And so she always wanted to go to school, and she couldn't go. And so she has a particular commitment. She has a strong commitment to finding, bringing lost souls back to their families, but mostly the children's soul. She's not really interested in soldier souls. Her biographical subjectivity interacts with the way she works as a spiritual entity in the later form of life. So but still remains. I feel that it remains unclear, reasonably unclear, how we can call these two forms of commemorative, two sides of commemorative structure: the ancestral home inside a family home, and the shelter for ghosts outside. But I do speak about these two forms of being in the book in the way that the ancestral home inside is close to what we believe is the image of traditional community, whereas the shelter for ghosts, or the face of ghosts as such, although the origin of the transformation was not was not something like these industrialization and urbanization as in Weimar Germany, from Bavaria to Berlin, but it also relates to a rupture in modern times, in a very violent time, mass mobilization and generalized displacement of human life. And so this shelter for ghosts does have elements of shelter for, modern individuals in the afterlife, or individuals created by the violence of modern history in the domain of the afterlife. So, and finally, I'll cut in 2 minutes, reciprocal effect. So I did speak about early on Moss's idea of how to think of the winter and summer, and how to think of these two forms of life of the Inuit, rather than as diametrical oppositions and dualistic terms. Yeah, we see it in dualistic terms. Well, what matters in seeing these two forms of life in dualistic terms is not duality as such, but how to think of what goes on between the two, how these two forms of life speak to each other. And then I turn to, in a like spirit, I turn to this structure of, once again, ancestors at home and the ghosts outside, and how they relate to each other. They don't relate to each other, but they relate to each other through the body of the commemorating person. So when the grandmother comes out in the morning, and then after giving a fresh water in the hands of her granddaughter, some fresh flowers to the ancestral shrine, she comes out in the morning, and she does it again in the evening, and brings offering to the shelter for ghosts. And through her body, the aesthetics of belonging, the sensation of belonging, unquestioned sensation of belonging, is there. And the fact that there is unquestioned sensation of belonging is materialized at home, provides a further sensation, stability and security and everything. But that's not all. This sense of security and stability does not exist on its own, but it does remember, it does account for the other side of her historical existence, which is still beholding the memories of displacement and unsolved histories of displacement, including her youngest son in this case. So by providing this, by having these two sites of memory, if you like, this grandmother of the family is able to account for her truthful historical experience and subjectivity better than having the situation of having only ancestral home, which cannot be entirely accountable for this complex and violent historical experience that she underwent, and like many other people in the region. So sympathy with displaced spirits is, as I said, is a long culturally grounded tradition in the specific sense in it is a religious and moral tradition whose relevance and strength are revived and reinvented in times of historical crisis and its aftermath. When this sympathy we enforce individual spirits or individuals in the afterlife arises on the horizon, its collective manifestation can challenge the existing order of the afterlife, in the sense the bringing about a radical change in the moral and hierarchical relationship between the ancestors inside and displaced spirits of the dead outside. What I'm saying is, although it continues, this structure continues the existing traditional cultural form, and then I think it at the same time it challenges it relates to the rupture of modern historical experience. In this case, I emphasize the mass and universal displacement of human life in modern, very modern, totalizing war. And so key to this ethical practice of commemoration, encompassing both inside and outside, and generating the reciprocal effects between two radically different, apparently radically different, sites of memory, is the awareness that the experience of displacement is constitutive of moral historical selfhood, and with reference to the matron of this family, that it is a fundamental fact that this ancestral sharing, the domestic site, the interior site of memory, is fundamentally unaccountable for her historical experience and subjectivity in general, in relation to her youngest son as well, then you create a further different ways to deal with these missing gaps in the existing, the dominant forms of commemoration. That is, the awareness that the condition of a stranger is part of me, it's not someone else's. Even though I live with this familiar spirit at home, there is a stranger in me. Because if there is a lost soul in me, and that it's me who remembers the condition of missed soul, lost soul, part of. So this awareness, the condition of a stranger, is part of me and part of every one of us in this region, and perhaps much beyond. And this is a kind of blunt statement I end with, because in the beginning I do talk about both reciprocal effects, and then I return to Marcel Mauss' teacher, the eminent anthropologist Emil Durkheim. And unlike the way we think, and I think Durkheim is very different. His work is very different. I don't think he fell for, like many German scholars did, to this duality of Bavarian Gemeinschaft versus Berlin Gesellschaft. Yes, he did fall for it to an extent, but I think he had this remarkable revolutionary understanding that inside Bavarian community, inside the ancestral home, where everything is well, inside French, you know, political society, against the external beings knocking on the door, inside this what seemingly familiar home, this familiarity arises when people forget that we were all born and started our human life as all strangers, even in most traditional home. Thank you very much.